You always tell them about their writings and about the titles that they've had. Why don't you tell us something about the person? So I will. I wrote an unsolicited memo regarding a position in the university, and part of the memo went as follows. In reading your memo on the blank blank position, I won't go as far as identifying the position, I thought immediately of Paul Friedman. In his previous appearances at the Miller Center, editing the letter, he won the esteem of young and old alike. I can see him reaching students from all disciplines and all grades, whether first year or postgraduate people. I believe he's due for a research leave one of these days, but I thought you would like to have record of his success at the Miller Center. And I wrote it because Paul is one of the people who I think has a quality often missing. Not only has he achieved mastery of his field, a very complex and demanding field, but he seems always to communicate it as though he was learning as he is stating what he knows. And that kind of, whatever you call it, is a quality I think which marks a great teacher. He had an upfront seat at election night 2000 as an ABC analyst for that election and sat in the group, the so-called decision desk. His fields for teaching are public opinion and media and politics, voting behavior, and research methods. He's done research and has a forthcoming book in the general area on campaign advertising, political politics and abortion, and political participation. And there are many other things one could mention. He's the expert at the Sorensen Institute. And it directs the project on campaign activities there, supported by the Pew Charitable Trust. And there are many more things one could say, but I think as we try to figure out something that all of us experienced election night 2000, it's not inappropriate that one listens to an expert who also has a passion for talking to all the rest of us who may not yet or ever have managed his techniques of analysis. So, election night 2000, Professor Paul Friedman.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks very much. I want to talk today about being wrong. In particular, two groups were rather famously wrong in the 2000 election and made rather weighty mistakes when it came to predicting the outcome of the 2000 presidential election. These two groups are first political scientists and second members of the media, and I'm proud to say I was a member of both for election night 2000, so I come before you with some regret, some embarrassment, but also hopefully a little bit of insight as to what went wrong. First, political scientists were wrong. How were we wrong? We were wrong in our predictions, our models, our forecasts. Political scientists confidently predicted, beginning in the really in the spring and summer of 2000, there were a series of well-respected, up until 2000, political scientists who made confident predictions that Al Gore would not just win the White House, but would win big, would win with anywhere from 53 to 60% of the two-party popular vote, a fairly large margin. Also, a fairly substantial overestimate, as we as we now know, the vice president won the popular vote, but by a hair, 50.2% of the two-party vote. political scientists were wrong, and they were wrong in a big way. However, that mistake, I think, pales in comparison to the mistakes made by the media, particularly the television networks, who were wrong on election night in a number of different ways, a number of different interesting ways and important ways. Most notably, the networks, and I speak of all of the networks because we were all wrong. The networks were wrong in calling the state of Florida, and therefore the presidency, because the mistakes surrounding the call for Florida really implied a mistaken call for the White House both times. The networks called Florida for Gore, then later that night for Bush, and then finally we uncalled it and we left it up in the air. We settled on no one at all, which turned out to be the right thing to do, at least for the next month. At the very least, these mistakes are embarrassing for the people involved. I joked with Ken that we should call today's talk Reliving the Nightmare of Election 2000. But we didn't want to scare anybody off, and we certainly didn't want to seem partisan. For a political scientist who spent election night at ABC News Decision Desk, as Ken mentioned, election night was quite an experience and really a fascinating one. I want to talk about the errors of of the media and political scientists as well, but I want to focus on the media because I think that that's where many of the big mistakes were made, some of the bigger mistakes, but I'll talk about political scientists at the end, so don't worry, we'll get to everybody. With respect to the media, I want to talk about three things. First, briefly, a recap of what happened on election day and election night. Second, I want to talk a bit about some of the explanations for why it happened, and I'll refer to these as the official explanations for why it happened. Finally, I'll sketch out my own explanation for why I think it really happened and give you a view of a new approach that I contend would guarantee that we never see the mistakes we saw on election night 2000 ever again. And so I'll tell you a little bit about what that might look like. So first, what happened on election night on television? A bit of background as to what television networks do on election night. In their efforts to serve the public by reporting the news and by reporting election results, television networks have for more than 50 years now reported the results of presidential election races on a state-by-state basis. Now, obviously, at first, this was a process that lasted late into the night as anchors and reporters waited for the votes to come in precinct by precinct and county by county. But of course, in more recent years, the television networks have developed a new and valuable tool that has helped them to predict the outcome of a race in a state before all the vote has been counted. And indeed, depending on the closeness of the race, exit polls allow television networks to call the race before the polls have even closed. Now, this is something that networks don't usually do. They're not supposed to do it, but it occasionally happens, and it happened on election night 2000. The exit poll is this new tool. Exit polls, as most of you probably know, involve sending teams of interviewers throughout the country to carefully selected polling places, to precincts in states across the nation, and interviewing a sample of voters, asking them a battery of questions, most notably for the purposes of predicting the outcome of the race, for whom did you just vote? It's on the basis of these answers then that the networks, by using exit polls, are in a position to make a usually fairly accurate prediction as to who the winner of the race is likely to be in that state. So one fundamental use of the exit poll is to make these early predictions. But there's a second, and I would argue more important, more interesting, potential use of exit polls, and this is as a tool for analysis, for understanding the dynamics of an election and understanding the bases of citizens' vote choice. In addition to the question, for whom did you just vote, exit polls gather all sorts of information. Many other questions are asked, some of them demographic, gender, race, education level, income level, but also other questions about perceptions of candidates, past voting behavior, issues that were important to that particular voter. and gathering these data make it possible to analyze and to really make some sense out of the election once it's over, but also as the election is unfolding and as the results are coming in. We know on the basis of these data, for example, that left-handed gun-owning widget makers from the South are more or less likely to vote for Gore or vote based on their position on the abortion issue or on taxes or on the education. And these are the kind of data that can really enhance the way that television news networks report the vote and can enhance our understanding of what was driving the election. For the purposes of making calls, though, it's really the first use of exit polls that gets the most play on election night. And this, of course, is making early predictions, early calls of winners and losers. Now, originally, exit polls are not easy to do. It takes resources, it takes knowledge, it takes money to send groups, to train groups of people throughout the country to send them to these polling places and to put into place a system for gathering and making some sense of the data and making the data available to analysts and decision makers and to anchors and reporters as well. So that in 1990, the various networks decided to do something smart. They decided to pool their resources. In the past, they had undertaken their own exit polls. Some of them had undertaken nationwide surveys. Others had just done selected areas. But in 1990, they realized we could save a lot of money if we do one exit poll. And so the networks joined together into a consortium that's now known as Voter News Services, or VNS. It's a consortium that in 2000 included ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, Fox News, and the Associated Press. So this was a group that had a good deal of money, a good deal of knowledge, and a good deal of experience in collecting data, in conducting these exit polls, and in making some sense of it. Working together as a consortium, as I say, makes a good deal of sense, primarily because it saves money. But it has some very important implications, and I'll get to those in a moment. Let me tell you what happened on election night, what you may have seen. One of the most interesting things about, in speaking to people after the fact, depending on when people turned off the television and went to sleep, if they didn't choose to stay up to the exciting conclusion, or what they thought would be the exciting conclusion, depending on when people went to sleep, they thought Al Gore had won the presidency, right? If you went to sleep at 8:30, you thought that you'd wake up to President Gore. Well, if you stayed up a little bit later, if you went to sleep at about 2:30, right, you'd be going to sleep with President Bush in your dreams, dancing in your dreams. If you had stayed up till about 4 in the morning, though, or the entire night, you wouldn't have known, right? You would have been, you would have known what we all knew, starting from the next morning and really lasting for the next 35 days, which was we don't know who our next president was, right? It's really quite striking if you think about it. I joked with a reporter about 4 days after the election that, this is 4 days, 4 long days that, good golly, you know, we haven't waited this long for the outcome of to learn the outcome of a presidential election since the days of the Pony Express, right? How naive I was. We all were 4 days into this thing. Little did we know it would be another 31 days and a whole lot of excitement before the whole thing was over. Well, the uncertainty that we all lived with for more than a month really began on election night, and it began at about 8 o'clock. At 7:50 p.m., with 10 more minutes of voting in the Florida panhandle, because as many people either didn't realize or didn't remember or didn't care about, Florida has two time zones. And in the panhandle, there was another 10 minutes left of voting. Nevertheless, the first network call for Al Gore was made. Al Gore, it was said, will take Florida, and therefore people were pretty sure he'd be the next president. Not totally sure, but pretty sure. By 8 o'clock, 10 minutes later, when the polls had finally closed, all of the networks had made the call that Al Gore would, in fact, win Florida. And I'm proud to say that ABC was dead last in making that prediction. Well, by 10 o'clock,
A mere 2 hours later, the Gore call had been withdrawn by everyone. The race, it was said, was clearly too close to call and to be confident in a winner. Well, that was 10 o'clock, and that's how things went, that's how things were, how they stood for another 4 hours by 2:10 in the morning. By the way, when I took this job, I figured, oh, you go home 11, 11:30, 12, right? I showed up at the studio, well, it wasn't actually the studio, it was a windowless room on the fourth floor of a building on 67th Street with some bread and stale bread and soggy salad on the outside. I got there at about 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning. At 4:30 in the afternoon, I went down to stretch my legs and have a slice of pizza. Aside from that, I was sitting at a computer drinking coffee from 11. I thought it would be 12 hours, but indeed, we finally left, ran to get a cab to get to LaGuardia to teach my class in Charlottesville, Virginia at about 7 the next morning, right? So by 2:10, we thought, this is shaping up to be a late night. By 2:10, 96% of all of Florida precincts had reported results, and it really looked as though Gore could not do it. Gore would have needed, according to the data that we were looking at on our screens, 63% of the outstanding vote in Florida. It seemed, to say the least, extremely unlikely. And 10 minutes later, ABC News projected a Bush victory. Again, I'm proud to say we were the last network to do so of all the networks. Only one institution, only one VNS partner did not make this call for Bush, and that was the Associated Press. VNS itself did not make a call for Bush, but we're all relying on the VNS data. I'll get back to that in a moment. Okay, so after blowing the Gore call, and that's a big embarrassment, I should say. That is a huge embarrassment. To get a state wrong in a presidential election. Well, after blowing it in Florida for Gore, the networks really believed that they had it right, and we all breathed a sigh of relief. As Dan Rather put it on the news, on the air, Dan Rather said confidently, "Sip it, savor it, photostat it, hang it out on a wall. George Bush is the next president of the United States." Well, he was right, of course, but he wouldn't actually be right for another 35 days. By 3 in the morning, CNN reported that Al Gore had called Governor Bush to concede. Holy moly, right? This is on the basis. Everybody's saying it. Dan Rather said, sip it, savor it, hang it on the wall, right? I'm sure Al Gore figured it's time to concede. Everybody knows it. In fact, it was 40 minutes later that Al Gore called to concede. Well, 40 minutes after that, 3:40 a.m., now Bush's once commanding lead in Florida has shrunk to 6,060 votes. And CNN reports that Al Gore just called back to deconcede or unconcede. That's never really happened before in American politics, and clearly the political actors themselves were carefully tuned into what was going on with the television networks and with the exit poll data that were coming into us. Okay. 3:57, 17 minutes later, after the deconcession, the Bush lead is now less than 2,000 votes, right? Which is to say it's really evaporated. CNN withdraws its call and the other networks follow shortly. So by 4 in the morning, it's all up in the air. We don't know. And that's the way it stays for the next 35 days. Well, this is a big deal, in part because, as I've suggested, Al Gore has made 2 phone calls now on the basis of what was being reported. It's also a big deal because the networks don't usually get it wrong. When they make a call, it's usually a good call. And in fact, here's another Dan Rather quote from the beginning of the evening, I'm sure Dan wishes he had never said this one. Dan Rather says on CBS News, "We would rather be last in reporting returns than to be wrong. If we say somebody has carried a state, you can pretty much take it to the bank, book it, because that's true." Well, that's what we would like to think, but as we've seen, Dan was wrong, and he was wrong again later when he told us to photostat it and hang it on the wall. The networks collectively got it wrong in 2000. They got it wrong in a big, embarrassing way. They did so twice, actually, in one night. And as Tom Brokaw has since said, we don't just have egg on our face, he says, speaking of the networks, we have a whole omelet. So the television networks have an omelet on their face. There have been some mistakes in the past. Most recently, and until 2000, most notably, in 1996 in the New Hampshire Senate race, Democrat Dick Sweat was projected to beat Bob Smith, who ended up winning by a full 6 points. That's a big gap. So before 2000, the worst mistake was the 1996 New Hampshire Senate race. And after 2000, nobody remembers that. The networks have never gotten a single state wrong twice in one night. So what the heck happened? How come Dan had to eat his hat and Tom had omelet? Everybody's eating something. Omelet on his face. Here's what happened. Here's why it happened, according to a series of official explanations that have come out. There have been, if you're interested in this stuff, or if you're having trouble sleeping at night, there are hundreds and hundreds of pages that have been written on this by the networks themselves. There have been internal reports by each of the networks, external reports that are all available online. There have been congressional hearings. I kid you not. This fiasco, Election Night 2000, and what the networks did was the topic of congressional hearings held by the House Energy and Commerce Committee. And the networks, I can tell you, took this very seriously, and you can read their testimony as well. So here's what happened according to the network's internal investigation and their public reports, and according to what was uncovered during the House hearings. First, when it comes to the Gore call at 8 o'clock at night, three official explanations. First, there was some evidence of a slight pro-Gore bias in the exit polls. This isn't too surprising because one of the things that journalists and political scientists have noticed over the past several elections is that exit polls sometimes have a bias that favors one candidate or another. And I use bias in sort of a statistical term here, not an intentional error, but simply an error on the side of the Democrat or Republican. More often than not, it has tended to be a Democratic bias. Some people speculate that Democrats are more willing to talk to exit pollers, pollsters. Republicans kind of keep it close. They spin this out into explanations that are rooted in the personality of Democrats and the personality of Republicans. Whatever the explanation, there has been and there was some slight pro-Gore bias in the exit polls. Not enough to explain the mistakes, in my opinion. Second and more important, as far as an explanation for the mistaken Gore call, was an underestimate of the absentee vote in Florida. And this turns out to be, I think, an important thing an important issue for future efforts to predict election outcomes on the basis of exit poll data to take into consideration. Because by definition, if you vote by absentee ballot or if you vote by mail, nobody's going to interview you as you leave your polling place. So it's essential that absentee ballots and early voting by mail or ultimately on the internet be somehow factored into these models, and they weren't done so adequately. The expectation, the prediction was that in Florida, absentee ballots would be 7% of the total vote. They turned out to be 12% of the total vote. And this is important because the absentee vote in Florida was 24 percentage points more Republican than the in-person vote. So that if you underestimate the absentee ballot, you're going to overestimate the share of the vote for Al Gore. Finally, the third explanation for the blown Gore prediction was that the estimates coming out of the system, the VNS system does all sorts of fancy things with the data, and one of the fancy things that it does was to adjust the data that are coming in to take into consideration past elections, and they give different weights to different past elections, and it turns out the system was giving more weight to the 98 gubernatorial race in Florida. It should have given more weight to the 96 presidential race in Florida. Well, that's sort of technical. Does it matter? Probably. Does it explain the entire Gore call? I don't think so. The Bush call at 2 in the morning, what went wrong there? Well, there are some more easily identifiable errors, some of them large ones that led the networks to be overconfident in predicting Bush, the winner in Florida, and therefore the winner in of the presidency. I'll march through these three very quickly. Volusia County, Florida, had a 20,000 vote undercount for Al Gore. This wasn't corrected until 12 minutes to 3 in the morning, right? So this inflated George Bush's apparent vote total considerably. Second, there were errors, additional errors in vote totals reported by Brevard County, a 4,000 vote Gore undercount, again, leading the networks and the analysts to think that Bush was doing better than he actually was. Finally, there were some very significant errors in the number of outstanding votes statewide, so that at one point it looked like there were 180,000 votes outstanding, ballots outstanding, and actually there were closer to 360,000 outstanding ballots. Thus, Gore would have needed far less than the 63% of the outstanding votes to win that we thought he needed. Okay, these are the official explanations. They're reasonable. They're well-researched. They make sense. Do they explain what happened on election night? I don't think they do completely, and I think they divert our attention to some more fundamental issues and some fundamental questions about what happens on election night. And so I want to make a slightly different kind of argument. I want to suggest that ultimately the failures on election night that we saw, the network's failures on election night, are rooted in the structure of the entire enterprise, the game, if you will, that has been set up. Fundamentally, what the networks are doing is competing. Election night is structured in a competitive way. It's a competitive context, and the networks are competing with one another. Right? This is the second competition. We all know it's Bush and Gore. What we don't realize, perhaps, is that at least in the eyes of the network, it's ABC versus CBS, NBC, CNN, Fox News, and the Associated Press. They are battling against one another because they all share a basic assumption. And the basic assumption is this: notwithstanding Dan Rather's claims to the contrary, for the networks, it is not enough to be right in making calls on election night. They also want to be first. And this drives everything else that they do. Now, incidentally, I have yet to meet anybody outside of the networks who pays attention to this, who keeps track, or who even cares. In fact, I don't know anybody who says, hey, I'm watching ABC because they made the wrong call last, or they made the right call first in states A, B, C, D. However, I can assure you that the networks take this very seriously. They want to be right, but they also want to be first. And it turns out that it's easy to be first in making a call. It's also easy to be right in making a call, but it's extremely difficult to be both. All right? If you tell me I just need to be first, I'll flip a coin, right? I'll choose randomly. I'll use the last Gallup estimate or Zogby estimate, pre-election survey in that state, and I'll use that as the basis for my prediction, and I'll be first, right? As long as I don't have to be right. If you tell me I don't have to be right, excuse me, I don't have to be first, I just have to get it right, well, that's easy too. I do what Dan said he was going to do, I just wait, right? I'll tell you tomorrow. Okay, the trick is in being first while being right. And if you think about it, if you ask, well, how can they do this? How can they compete to be first? How can the networks vie for being first while being right? There's really only three ways that they can go. First is they can compete by collecting better data. They can get a competitive advantage if they have better information. Well, as I've suggested, this is pretty much impossible when everybody's using the same information, right? That's one of that's the fundamental implication of pooling the network's resources, right, so that there's only one exit poll. Nobody can do better by getting better data. Except, I mentioned that AP, the Associated Press, failed to make the Bush call. They did not make the Bush call. As it turns out, the Associated Press had a secondary system for gathering data. In addition to being part of the VNS consortium, the AP had a backup system, right, in place, left over from the pre-VNS days. And it's on the basis of those data, of that backup system, that AP was able to hold off and not get it wrong for the second time that night. All right. So getting better data would help the networks do a better job, but they've taken that, for the most part, off the table. Second, networks can do a better job of analyzing the VNS data that they get. And this is where people like me come in. And in fact, ABC was the first network really to defect from the partnership. And they did this in 1994. Prior to 1994, everybody in VNS was relying both on the data as they were coming in and on the analysis provided by the VNS analysts. In 1994, ABC News got smart, or got cute. They said, we're going to hire our own people, we're going to get better analysis, faster analysis, and we're going to report the results in the states sooner. Well, once they did it, it was like proliferation. It was like the unraveling of an arms treaty. Everybody else had to do it. And now, not just ABC News, but all of the networks have their own decision desks, teams of journalists, political scientists, political professionals who, like those of us at ABC, are looking at the data as they come in all night and attempting to make some sense of it, working towards a prediction. Okay, so analysis is the second way, but ultimately you get diminishing returns, right? Once everybody gets good analysis, it's hard to eke out marginal increases in quality. So the third way, and the most dangerous way, that networks can compete in calling an election first is by a willingness to be wrong. A willingness to make a prediction even if you're not as certain as you should be. ABC and the other networks say that they want to be 99.95% sure before they make a call. That's the official line. But think about the logic. If you're waiting to be 99.9% sure, I'm going to make a prediction when I'm 99% sure. Or 95% sure, or 90% sure, or 80% sure. There is an incentive, I'm suggesting, to take risks, so long as the premium is not just on being right, but being first. And if you think about it, right, 80% that's a pretty good bet. Somebody told you that your team had an 80-85% chance of winning, I'd bet on them. That's pretty good. However, over many calls during the course of the night, because remember, we're not just calling the 50 states, we're calling Senate races, gubernatorial races, House races as well. If I'm always making a prediction at when I'm 80% sure, I'm going to get a few wrong, and I'll probably get a few big ones wrong. But there's something else to keep in mind. If I make a call when I'm only 80% sure, I'm usually going to be right, and when I'm right, nobody's going to know that I was only 80% sure. All right? So this is a kind of a hard thing to think about, but a bad call, which is to say a premature forecast, is still a bad call, even if it's right. Okay? So I can take a risk, and if I'm usually right, people won't know how risky I was being. It's only when I'm wrong that it will become apparent. Okay. The point I'm trying to make is that the competitive structure here builds in incentives to be risky and to make a call before it's done, right? We will sell no wine before it's time. We shouldn't make a call before it's time, and yet there are incentives to do so. Okay. Built-in incentives to take risks, and this is important, when what's at stake isn't a Senate seat a congressional race, a gubernatorial race, but rather a key state such as Florida in a presidential race, when that state has 25 electoral votes and is likely to decide the election, right? The stakes are extremely high, and from the perspective of the networks, being last is pretty much unacceptable. Not making a call after everybody else has, and not the 10 minutes that ABC waited, but you know, if we had just held our ground and not made a call at all, that's not just unacceptable, that's unimaginable. That is unimaginable for a news network. The calculation for the network is, and pretend you're at ABC News, everybody else has called Florida and therefore the presidency for, let's say, George Bush, 2 a.m. What are you going to do? Do you risk, if they're right, do you risk being wrong, alone? Of course, had you held your ground like the AP did, if Peter Jennings had said, you know what, everybody else is calling this thing for George Bush, but at ABC News, we think it's too close to call. We're not willing to make the call. Peter Jennings would be a hero. We would be heroes, right? I'd probably got to, you know, go out to dinner with Peter. He would have thanked me, right? With his full-page ad in the New York Times, ABC News, the only one to hold the ground, the only one not to make these two mistakes, right? We would have been heroes. But the risk of being the only network not to say, George Bush is the president, where the heck is Peter Jennings and Cokie and Sam? Why aren't they telling us this, right? That would have been a disaster. Okay? Far better to be wrong along with everybody else and have to go before the House Energy and Commerce Committee, not just David Westin alone, but David Westin with everybody else. I suspect that rather than having dinner with Peter Jennings, had we not made a call, had we on the decision desk refused to say we think it's going to be Gore or Bush, we would have been fired on the spot, taken down to the ABC News dungeon, right? I'd have George Stephanopoulos would have been bringing me gruel the next day and for the next, the duration of my sentence. Okay, I think I've communicated the context, the environment, the decision-making calculation that really drives this. And if I'm right about this, I don't think it's that controversial. I think people would agree that to some extent or another, this is the competitive context of election night. If I'm right, what are we going to do about it? Well, I've got the solution. And it's a guaranteed solution, a guarantee that nobody ever makes a mistake in calling a race again, let alone making two mistakes in calling a race in one night. And it's a surefire way, 100%, and I will tell you what that way is. Stop calling races. Don't do it. If you don't make a call, I guarantee you, you won't be wrong. 100%, 100% guarantee. Well, then what are they going to do? What are we all going to tune into the next election night? Well, under the Friedman model, under this alternative approach, there'd be a lot to tell. There'd be a lot to show. There'd be a lot to teach people on election night. We could move away from the current model of calling the election in each state and instead simply give an honest account of the information we have at hand. Essentially, Peter Jennings would get up and say, look, here's what we know. Here's what's going on in Florida, right? Here's how confident we are, based on the data that we have, that George Bush is going to win or Al Gore is going to win, and just share that information. Now, this doesn't mean that you have to tell them anything that's wrong. It doesn't mean you have to give away state secrets. It just means you tell the truth, you tell the information that you have, that you've paid a lot of money to get, and you give it to people. Now, this can be, I think, some really exciting news. Really exciting television. Imagine watching television on election night, and instead of waiting, are they going to make a call? They make a call. Now we go on to the next state, or we wait for the call to be undone, as we saw this this year. Imagine an ongoing presentation of data, essentially, so viewers would see the same kind of information that I saw the entire night on the decision desk, which is a fascinating story of a race unfolding before my eyes. Imagine watching the news, and they're talking about Florida, and you see two bar graphs a bar for Bush and a bar for Gore, and then maybe a little pie or a third bar that, or just even some a number saying here's how confident we are based on the available data. And stay tuned as the bars move up and down, or one gets bigger and the other gets smaller, right? Or they get closer, or they change throughout the night. To me, that's kind of neat television. That's compelling television. And that's at least as gripping as Cokie and Sam and everybody, you know, killing time until somebody whispers in their ear, okay, we're ready to make a call. Now, having been one of those people whispering in the ear, that was exciting. That was a lot of fun. I hope to do it again, so please don't tell the people at ABC that I'm saying all of these things. But if they really took my advice, right, they would just completely scrap the model of calling races and move to this, again, what I think is a more compelling approach to sharing information about what is going on throughout the night in a visually, I think, interesting way. All right, will this happen? I don't think so. I'm pretty sure it won't happen. I tried to tell them. I gave them this great idea. I told them they could have it for free. And yet, what we have seen in the wake of the congressional investigation, in the wake of the reports that have been generated, is the response has been a commitment and a promise to essentially do a better job of doing what we've been doing the whole time, which is to say to keep calling races on election night. And in the short run, I actually believe, and from what I've seen, I do believe that they will do a better job. I am doubtful that we're going to see another Florida. I think that at least in the short run, it's going to be better. But over the long term, after several election cycles, I suspect that the competitive pressures, this competitive environment that I've sketched out, will come back into play, and that these incentives to be a little risky in order to beat the competition will reemerge. And so ultimately, I think that unless we change the starting assumption that the goal is not only to be right but to be first, I think we could well have another Florida. Okay, that's the media on election night.
Can we have a little discussion of this, Paul?
We surely can. I will stop by simply saying that if you like the media, you'll love political science, political scientists, because we actually got it right. Okay, the political science model said that Gore would win. They said it from the beginning, and in fact, because what they were predicting, not who was going to be in the White House on inauguration day, but who is going to win the two-party popular vote. So when we think about when David Broder criticizes the performance of the political science models, keep in mind that what these models are trying to predict is the outcome of the popular vote, and indeed, Al Gore won the popular vote. So political scientists were right on some level, but these models predicted that Gore would win with between 53 and 60% of the popular vote, not 50.2% of the two-party popular vote. So later we can talk about where political scientists went astray and whether it's possible to fix that.
And if you want to thank the person who gave us the last 5 minutes of that discussion, thank Bo, who stopped the noise. Who'd like to begin the discussion? Is Bill Stevenson?
Could you comment on the reports I've read that the premature calling of these various states cost Bush too many votes, and the premature calling Bush in 12,000 votes. The lower figure was the figure derived from Democrat strategy.
Sure, it's a good question. I mentioned in my talk that the initial call in Florida was made at 7:50. When in fact there were 10 more minutes of voting in the Florida panhandle. The networks have in the past, and this had, 2000 was not the first series of congressional hearings. There have been prior investigations into the use and perhaps abuse of exit polling and the calling of election outcomes. And one of the issues has been, do we make a call while the polls were still open. All right, keep in mind, first of all, that under my approach, that wouldn't be an issue because we'd simply be sharing information, except that even under my approach, people in Florida who had yet to go out to vote could turn on the television and say, well, here's where things stand. So I suspect that some people, even in my scenario, might have qualms about reporting information before the polls have closed. It's a thorny question, and it's got some obvious First Amendment implications. Do we say, does Congress ban the networks from making a call before the polls have closed, regardless of whether or not it's prohibited legally? What should the networks do? What should the news media do when anchors and reporters know something before the public knows it? What are their responsibilities? So there are all sorts of fascinating questions here. What the networks have said in the response to past criticism is, we simply will adhere to a voluntary standard of not reporting the outcome of a race, not calling the outcome of a race before the majority of the polls in that state have closed. And this majority has usually been interpreted as meaning 80%. My understanding is that by 7:50, close to 80% of the precincts in Florida were closed. However, there were still 10 more minutes of voting, and the question becomes, what effect, if any, did this have? My response to the estimates is, it's really extremely difficult to get an accurate estimate of how many people did vote or didn't vote on the basis after this call had been made, in part for some obvious reasons. How are you going to do it, right? Are you going to call people around the state, take a survey, and say, did you vote, could you have voted, would you have voted? There are some real challenges to making those estimates. I think it is likely that there were some people who were going to vote for George Bush and heard that Al Gore had been declared the winner, and they stayed home, or they turned the car around, or they left the line. How many people? I have no way of knowing. I know that these estimates are out there. I think we should take them with some degree of salt, some number of grains of salt. I think that there are good reasons to question both the high and the low estimates. Ultimately, we don't know. If there's one thing that political science knows, is that there are good reasons to expect people to come out to vote when they think that their candidate, their favored candidate, is ahead. There are also good reasons for people to come out to vote when they think that their candidate is behind. We call these bandwagon effects and underdog effects, and there's been some evidence to support both of them. So ultimately, this is a long-winded answer to a really good question, and ultimately it comes down to, I don't know.
Next question, toward the back. Dr. Edgerton, and then first Dr. Edgerton, then you.
Can you give us some idea of accuracy of exit polling? Has any study been made to find out how reliable those verbal responses are? Are there high correlations with the final results taken?
Yeah, good question. One of the fun things about an exit poll that you can't say about regular polls is you can hold it up to reality. If I do a survey right now and ask for people's support for the way that George W. Bush is handling his job as president, I'll get a number. Okay, and I can compare it to other numbers that other people have gathered in other surveys, but there's no hard objective reality the way there is with an exit poll, where you can hold it up to the result. What's that? You can hold it up to the result and see if it's right. There are always concerns that people are going to be misleading in their answers. Frankly, I think that is no more a concern with exit polls than it is with other survey research. I think a bigger concern is this question of selection bias. Are Republicans or Democrats more or less likely in a given state, in a given precinct, to speak to the interviewers? Ultimately, the answer is that exit polls have done a pretty good job. They have been they have done a good job of projecting both nationally, right, because at the same time the state level surveys are aggregated to produce a national portrait of the electorate. And both nationally and at the level of the states, they've done a very good job of in the past of calling the races, particularly because particularly in retrospect, when the data can be adjusted to reflect the reality in particular states. So the answer is that exit polls are not perfect. They are not much better nor much worse than the kinds of public opinion surveys we encounter daily.
Back in the room.
I was wondering if you thought that one of the reasons why Gore won was wrong was they did not anticipate the high number of African Americans and other votes that were going to be thrown out because of voter error.
Yeah, somebody shortly after the discovery of the now famous butterfly ballot in Palm Beach County that has really been shown to have given a real edge to Pat Buchanan. Somebody said, well, maybe the exit polls were right and people were honestly saying I voted for Gore when in fact they had just cast a ballot for Pat Buchanan or they had just spoiled a ballot. There may be something to that, but not enough to account for this difference. African-American voters being disenfranchised, again, I think to the extent that, and by the way, there has been a recent report from the Commission on Civil Rights that looked into it and found real evidence of, according to the report, some systematic, whether or not it was intentional is another question, disenfranchisement in part due to the purging of lists, et cetera. This election just keeps going on and on and on. Whether or not that was enough to or happened in such a way that had implications for the predictions of the outcome, I don't know. I don't think that the nature of the way that played out could account for enough of what we've seen. Certainly there was a higher African American turnout in Florida in particular than was expected. That may have crept into play when it comes to the way that the system weights data, right? Again, if black turnout had been lower in past races, it may have led to some misleading estimates in 2000. So it's possible that the system made some errors or that was part of the errors made by the computer models this year.
You always ask good questions. Tell us your name before you...
My name is Barry Sunnewall. Much attention has been focused here and earlier on the question of early poll closing in Florida and just calling the election. It seems to me, I wonder if another interesting question would be closing the polls, calling early with regard to California, say the west of the country, and the probability of the network to making a mistake. Not just calling it, but making a mistake.
Well, sure, because, you know, absolutely. It's one thing to call a race early, okay, and thereby possibly affect the outcome, either of that race or really what's, yeah.
The national race.
Right, the national race. But one of the concerns there is not only the implications for people voting at the top of the ticket, but for the down ballot races. So that in the early 1980s, when early calls were made, correct calls were made in California, the concern was that people stayed home, not only people who would have voted for Jimmy Carter in 1980, but people who would have voted for Democrats down the ticket, thereby hurting them, possibly costing them the election. And so that is absolutely a concern. And if you put on top of that the notion that you may be making the wrong call, I think one begins to see at least the appeal of a reform such as the uniform poll closing idea that really has picked up some speed. And in the congressional hearing, I think every network executive expressed support for having a national uniform, which is to say it would be, you know, 8 o'clock on one coast, 11 o'clock on the other coast, but the same time to eliminate some of these concerns.
Yes.
Bill Burke. There's a report, I believe it's accurate, that there were 20,000 unmarked ballots, I believe, coming out of the Miami-Dade area. How can exit polls be right?
Excellent question, and I will give you a very simple answer. As long as those kinds of errors are not systematic errors, it's not a problem for exit polls. What is a problem is if those 20,000 ballots or the many more thousands of ballots that were unintentional undervotes, or the even the almost equal number of ballots that were unintentional overvotes, many of which subsequent analysis by news organizations have shown to be cases in which people successfully poked a chad for example, Al Gore, and then came to the write-in part and wrote Al Gore, thereby invalidating, at least in some counties, but not in all, invalidating their ballots. As long as these kinds of errors, these kinds of mistakes are not systematically related or do not systematically advantage one candidate or another, it's not a problem. It is a problem if it turns out that these errors entail a bias, which is to say that Gore voters are more or less likely to hang a chad, overvote, mark two choices, right, or live in a place where their vote is, you know, tucked away somewhere and discovered only after the election. So that's the answer. But if there is evidence that there is a bias, yes, indeed, the exit polls are going to be wrong. And to the extent that those errors constitute a significant proportion of the total votes cast, they might be wrong by a significant amount.
Bob Burnett.
I wonder if I could take you to the bottom line. As a political scientist, analyst, benefit of 6 months, almost more than half a year, the so-called impartial recounts that you and Dershowitz spoke on the Supreme Court. In your view, did we come to the correct result?
Well, that really is the bottom. That's about as far. There's a new book out, actually, that has the subtitle, How Al Gore Tried to Steal the Election. I think when it comes to accusations of electoral theft, there are plenty to go around. I will do my best to evade your question and fail and not answer by saying that, first of all, by recognizing that what we saw was truly incredible. Any little piece of it would have been a divided Senate, right? We forgot about that. That the fact that the Senate ended up 50-50 ordinarily would have been big news, right? We barely even noticed it because there was so much else going on. These kinds of mistakes, these kinds of errors, and then the spectacle of the next 35 days. Do you remember? Right? Remember way back when we were glued to our television sets? By the way, the CNN website did something that is akin to what, in the recount, to what I'm talking about, right? It had the recount, the votes for Gore, the votes for Bush, and then the number of counties that had been recounted. You hit reload on your computer browser, boom, it's updated. Now it's 41 counties, right? And it's this exciting, I mean, I was sitting there for hours at a time, reload, 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 waiting for them to get more, right, says something about me, more information. So first I want to just recognize how incredible and how really unusual this is. And it was an election. Here's one bottom line that nobody knew how to deal with, right? Two of my colleagues have books that are either newly out or about to be out on the 2000 election. Jim Caesar, Larry Sabato has a book coming out. It's got a great title to describe election 2000. Overtime, right? It's the election that went into overtime, serious overtime. Jim Caesar's book has a super title also, and I think this title gets to a bottom line. It's not the one you want. It's called The Perfect Tie. The election of 2000, The Perfect Tie. The Perfect Tie, not The Perfect Tie, The Perfect Tie. Because I think in a real sense, what we see in the election of 2000, both in terms of the problems of political science predictions, early predictions, and in terms of the mistakes made by the networks, and in terms of the spectacle of this insanity that ensued for 35 days, what we see ultimately is a political system, a media, a profession of academics grappling with something that we rarely see, a tie, right? The bottom line then, and once you've recognized this as really the unique feature of Election 2000, then sure, it makes sense. 50.2%. Wow, right? 49.8%. Well, suddenly, it's easy to see one side or the other or both or the legislature or the state Supreme Court or the United States Supreme Court stealing the election, right? That's what it looks like, depending on where you sit. Somebody has stolen the election that rightfully belonged to my candidate. Well, why is it that it looks this way? Is our electoral system so fragile that we have accusations of theft? I think ultimately the reason it's easy for us on both sides to see these kinds of shenanigans as having gone on is that it was a tie in a very real sense. Right, I mean, the 0.2 of a percentage point mean that it wasn't a tie, but for all intents and purposes, this is as close to dead even as it gets in American politics. And I think that goes at least part of the way to explaining what we saw both on election night and in the aftermath.
We have 13 people who have notified us they wanted to have lunch with our speaker, even before hearing him. And if there are seven more, or a few more than that, who can make the case and let me know, or let somebody know,